Hello and welcome to the very first episode of STEM Z Perspectives. This podcast is hosted by the Young Scientist Journal, an organization run by 12 to 21 year olds that primarily focuses on giving young scientists a voice and a platform to publish their research and articles.
And this is actually our first podcast, and generally we're aiming to have young researchers on the show and to learn a bit about what they do. So we'll probably also be discussing scientific fields that are currently in the news and occasionally ones that may be lesser known.
Today's episode will be hosted by myself, Anish Mopadi, and I'm interested in artificial intelligence and computer science.
Yeah, and I'll also be hosting today's episode, and my name is Harry Cordo, and I'm interested in engineering and earth sciences.
Nice. All right, so today we'll be talking about climate change. We'll also be discussing the effects of coronavirus and lockdowns around the world on the environment and the climate, and in general, how we can use this great human pause, as some people call it, to implement real change in relation to climate change. Finally, we'll also be interviewing Dr. Michael Mestrandrea, a climate scientist and senior research associate at the Carnegie Institution of Science at Stanford and the director of Near Zero, an organization whose goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to zero through research and policy proposals.
So to start off with the topic of climate change, I mean, it hardly needs an introduction, because it's one of the greatest challenges that I think we as a human race face today.
Yeah, and some people could actually make the argument that climate change actually increases our risk of pandemics, with animals migrating closer to humans due to habitat loss and large livestock farms. There's an increase in the risk of emergence of zoonotic diseases, you know, the diseases that come from animals.
Yes, and there's also studies which suggest, such as one from Harvard, which suggests air pollution, which is more prevalent in poorer and urban areas, is associated with the increased risk of COVID-19 deaths. I think this specific statistic was associated with an 8% increase in the COVID-19 death rate.
Wow, that's insane. And arguably the pandemic was preventable. I mean, we've all seen the famous Bill Gates TED Talk, where he emphasizes the need to set up infrastructure to battle emerging infectious diseases. And we've seen in the past, and we've understood how dangerous and deadly Ebola and SARS could have been if they neared the scale of the COVID-19 pandemic that we have today. It could really be argued that just as the pandemic could perhaps been more controllable, we really need to start considering the preemptive challenge of climate change in a more serious way before severe consequences begin to hit.
Yes, and our guest later today will talk a bit more about what governments can do at a policy level, and also how we can begin to adapt to climate changes. I mean, we've already seen some changes as a result of the pandemic. For example, with the UK government encouraging bikes and also increasing demand for electric vehicles in the UK. The EU recovery deal has a 30% climate spending share, although apparently this is still below the required sum to meet their climate goals. But I mean, this is still promising to hear.
Yeah. And yeah, so this impact of lockdowns have meant that the governments almost have the opportunity to start over and build a greener economy. And the impact of cars on air pollution was clear with those NASA satellite images. I think the lockdown has meant that more people in the general public are beginning to realize just how much we've impacted the environment. And so I really think there should be a turning point.
But I guess it depends on whether governments around the world are willing to take decisive steps to make this happen, and whether they're willing to be at the forefront of the battle against climate change. And so let's turn to our guest, Dr. Michael Mestrandrea, to find out about his work on climate change and policy.
Hello, Dr. Mestrandrea. Thank you for coming to our podcast. So we have a couple questions to really ask about the impact of the coronavirus and lockdowns on kind of the climate change and policy. But before we get to that, could you tell us a bit about what you do and how you became interested in this area of research?
Sure, yes, and thank you very much for having me to the podcast. So I am a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science, which is on Stanford University's campus in California. Mm-hmm. And my current work, as you mentioned, focuses on climate and energy policy, also on managing the risks of climate change. I've also, I was part of the leadership team for the last round of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, fifth assessment report that was released a few years ago. And that's an international assessment of climate science and policy that's targeted for world governments thinking about climate policy internationally. And I was always interested in science growing up, but I didn't really start focusing on climate change until I got to college. And during my sophomore year at college, I was at Stanford, I took a class from a professor named Stephen Schneider and started doing some summer research projects with him, ended up doing an honors thesis my senior year, and then continued some of that work into grad school. And it really was something where this was in starting in kind of the late 90s when climate change awareness and understanding of the science was really starting to accelerate and grow. And so it has become a lifelong passion for me. I've worked both on the more of the scientific aspects of climate change, and then more recently thinking a lot about what do we do about it? How do we think about the different policy options, both in terms of adapting to the impacts of climate change we're already seeing, and also to reducing emissions so that we avoid worse impacts in the future?
Okay, so could you talk about how economics, policy, and climate science are intertwined together, so as one sort of string of science, if you like?
Absolutely. I think they're really closely intertwined. I think it's a great question. I would add equity to that list as well. I think it's really important if you're thinking about climate change to also understand all of these kinds of interactions that you just mentioned. So here in California, for instance, where I live, we're increasingly seeing the economic and the societal impacts of climate-related risks. For instance, the major wildfires that have really become a yearly ordeal here in California and in other parts of the world as well. And California also is a place that has really ambitious climate goals in terms of reducing emissions and a robust portfolio of climate policies that are already starting to show progress in reducing emissions. But there's a lot more work to do, and also we're increasingly seeing, as I said, the risks. So these kinds of interactions between economics and policy and science of climate change and equity issues are all really on full display here. I think it's a really important test bed for thinking about what are things that we can do and how can we do those in different parts of the world in different contexts.
Yeah, that's very interesting, the fact that you kind of start off from California and then kind of move on with that policy. But I guess the pressing question is, how would you say that, you know, coronavirus and these lockdowns have really impacted on your approach to climate policy and how you see it changing as a turning point?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this year the world has changed in fundamental ways, and that's not going to be, you know, we don't even know where it's going to be coming out exactly. Obviously, we're still in the midst of that. And obviously, I think that affects, too, as you say, the thinking around climate change and other societal challenges while we're immediately facing this really critical pandemic and all of the activities that are going on around the world around that and all of the impacts of that around the world. You know, again, I think one of the ways that comes to top of my mind that I think you're alluding to is that certainly one thing that we're seeing is the effects of all of the shutdowns for health reasons on emissions in different parts of the world. And I've looked at some of that research and seen that, for instance, if you looked at the peak of the declines in greenhouse gas emissions that were associated with the various shutdowns, say in March or April of this year, some of the numbers I've seen indicate that emissions went down something like 20% at their peak and then started to rebound after that. And so to me, one of the things this shows is that behavioral change, really dramatic behavioral change in this case, can have a big effect on emissions. But going down 20% still means that there's 80% of the emissions still happening. And so I think it also indicates that kind of behavioral change really can't address the issue alone. And so we also need to be thinking about changing, as we already know, where our energy comes from. And I do think another aspect of this is that these kinds of fundamental changes in the world, I think, also do open up opportunities to think larger about structural changes that also address societal challenges beyond COVID, like climate change. And so there's an opportunity for that kind of a question and that kind of a conversation. But obviously, I think the immediate focus is on thinking about these short-term health implications, addressing the pandemic itself. But coming out of that and even during it, I think there is that opportunity for conversation. One other way that it ties in is that another thing coming back to California that we're thinking about here is that the wildfire season that I mentioned before is coming up. We're already starting to see some wildfires here in Southern California. And usually when people evacuate because of these fires, they go to large gymnasiums or other kinds of group centers, which you can't really do in the same way because of the potential for exposure to COVID. And so there's a lot of, again, interfaces between these kinds of issues, both in the immediate and in the long term.
So was that 20% drop in commissions as a result of the coronavirus pandemic?
So I've seen some research that indicates that back in April, it was something like that, but only, for a few weeks. So if you look at what that might mean for the emissions for the year, it would be less than that, maybe something more like 7 or 8%. I haven't seen final numbers on what people think the total emissions will be for the year 2020. But it shows the immediate effect. That's the 20% that I was talking about.
Yeah, because obviously the 20% in about 10 years' time will not be enough to last us through longer. And you have a book called Preparing for Climate Change. So how can governments begin to start adapting to climate change, which you argue needs to begin now, of course?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so that book was one that I wrote with the professor that I mentioned earlier, Stephen Schneider. And what we were really talking about there is that, and this was written a few years ago, I think you've seen this just even increasingly in the years since that book was written, that adaptation is already happening across the world because we're already seeing the emergence of climate impacts, but also in anticipation of the future impacts that are already baked into the system because of past emissions. And so I think of adaptation as really an important part of risk management. So we need to be thinking about reducing emissions to avoid more severe impacts in the future, but we also need to be thinking about how we insulate ourselves or reduce the impacts that we're already seeing and that we will be seeing in the coming years. So one way that this is happening is that governments increasingly are really integrating climate risks into their planning, into their infrastructure investments, into the ways that they manage resources like water resources or forest resources, also into land use planning in terms of thinking about coastal communities or other kinds of coastal infrastructure, and a whole range of other types of planning and decision making. In terms of individuals, I would say that extreme events like heat waves, heavy storms, floods, droughts, wildfires again, are the places where climate-related impacts really materialize most immediately for people. And that's something where it's not necessarily that any individual event is quote-unquote caused by climate change. Instead, what climate change is doing is changing the frequency, how often you see these kinds of events, changing their intensity, and changing the impacts that occur when they happen. And it also, of course, climate change is interacting with then other factors of where people are living and what kinds of vulnerabilities there are in different communities or in different types of infrastructure. And so, I think in the short term, adaptation can really mean better preparing for disasters, for those kinds of events that I was just talking about. But it also in the longer term can mean more fundamental changes, like changing where and how you live. And lastly, I'll say too, that I think it's clear that society can't simply eliminate all the impacts of climate change through adaptation. We can reduce those impacts, but it's important, as I said before, to also reduce the emissions, because otherwise you're going to get to a point where you start to reach limits to what you can do through adaptation.
Yeah, it's very interesting, the things that you mentioned, like the regional specifics of different climate change in different societies and how that can produce different changes on a global level. And it kind of begs the question, how much can an individual action really affect our climate change, and how can we reduce as a general public? Because I know, if, for example, if I, did an action to try to save some of the water I use in my house, or the plastic, or any sort of climate change reducing action, how much of an impact can that have unless, the society kind of comes together?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, I think it's easy to think of those individual actions as so small that they don't actually mean anything. But I think that that's totally false, and that those actually really do matter. They absolutely matter, because the collective effect of lots of people taking those actions is ultimately what's going to change the overall systems and the overall societal impacts. And so, you know, you mentioned water efficiency, you mentioned plastics. Those are great examples. I think lots of other aspects of energy efficiency, of how much energy we use and what kinds of energy we use, are really important. So, you know, that can be your light bulbs and whether you turn your lights off when you leave a room, and it's as simple as that. But it can also mean things like how your home is heated, or if you have air conditioning, and whether it's being used efficiently, where the electricity that is powering those appliances is coming from, whether those are fossil fuel power plants or whether it's more renewable energy, for instance. Some of those things, you know, go beyond where individuals can usually control within their home, but they can make choices about how they use energy, what kinds of appliances that they have in their home. Also, mobility is another really important aspect. So, you know, many of us are not driving cars in the same way that we used to, and are thinking about how we get around when we do go different places. And, you know, I think public transportation is obviously one aspect of that. In a lot of areas, the rise of electric vehicles or other kinds of zero emissions vehicles, as opposed to traditional gas cars. And these, again, are all really important aspects of, ultimately, there are things that we want to use energy for. People talk about energy services as one of the buzzwords for this, where we want to get around. We want to have light at night. We want to be able to have a refrigerator that cools our food and keeps it fresh for when we want to eat it, those kinds of things. There are different ways that we can get the energy to use for those things. And it's really important to be thinking about where ours is coming from in different contexts. So that's, you know, kind of one domain. I think another aspect of it that's really important to mention is participation in civil society, where individuals can also let their representatives in the government know that this is something that's a priority and that they would like to see different options available to them, or policies that are addressing the root causes of the emissions that come from energy use or from other sectors like agriculture, for instance. And so I think that's another really important way that people who are interested can get involved in the process and get involved in the broader societal conversation about how to address the risks that we're seeing.
Okay, so you talked about mobility and things that the public can do to change their climate habits and the amount of emissions that they produce as a member of society or as a household. What can the general public do to get the climate policy at the forefront of politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, continuing on from what I said just now, it's a bit of a cliche, but I think that it is extremely important to let government representatives know, if it's a priority to you, that to communicate that to them, because I think everybody in the world has limited bandwidth, including policymakers. But if they see that this is something that's a priority to the people that they represent, then it's an issue that will rise more to the top of the different issues that the policymakers are always grappling with at the same time. Again, I think, you know, civil society and NGOs and other kinds of nonprofit organizations and those kinds of institutions can also help amplify these kinds of messages. Another thing that I think is kind of a longer term strategy, but is to think about a career in this field. And I say that very broadly, both the scientific field, but there's lots of other aspects of this. Climate change is really something that's one of the defining issues of our time. There's others, of course, as well, but it's certainly one of them. And I think there's lots of ways to get involved in bringing this this kind of transition that people are imagining, where there's lots of different ways that pathway from where we are now to the kinds of societal outcomes that people are thinking about when you're talking about addressing climate change, how those pathways happen. And that's both places where science can play an important role in providing analysis and research and information that helps inform those decisions. But ultimately, those decisions about where societies go in the future involve a lot of value judgments that extend well beyond what science alone can provide. And so that's where, again, coming back to one of your earlier questions, policy, economics, equity, all of the different kinds of stakeholders in the world that have different interests and different perspectives need to come together to be talking about these kinds of things. And that's something that can happen in a political process. It can happen in social conversations and societal debates and things like that as well. But I think these are really important places where engagement and awareness are important aspects of it, but also, you know, directly getting involved in different ways, depending on your interests, or something that's really, really important and can be really powerful as well.
Yeah, thank you. That's very inspiring, and especially nowadays with the high schools in different countries where we have environmental clubs, allows us to really voice the opinions of the youth who really do have a concern for climate policy, and talking to representatives. So I guess the next question is, in one of your research papers, you talk about baking behavior as something that can create stringent cap and trade programs. Could you kind of elaborate on that for some of our listeners and talk about how your team came through this approach?
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to. So I think the original motivation, at least one of them that I would say, is that if you look at, in theory, how climate policies, including cap and trade, might be designed, there can be a very big difference between that theoretical design and what actually then gets implemented in the real world. And so what we were really interested in thinking about was, how do we understand the real world performance of a cap and trade system? In this case, we were looking at the system that's here in California, that's linked to a system in Quebec as well in Canada. I think, as I mentioned before, in California, cap and trade is one part of a portfolio of climate policies that California brings to bear on the issue. And so one of the ways we wanted to look at this was, how does that real world performance of cap and trade compare to the expectations about what its role was going to be in achieving the economy-wide reduction targets that California has set, where cap and trade was expected to do part of the job, but other policies were also expected to do other parts of the job. And so, you know, if you look at the performance of the system to date, something that becomes immediately clear is, in a cap and trade system, as you probably know already, there's a supply of allowances that allow you to emit. And so there's a certain supply of the currency of the market. And then there's a demand for those allowances, which is how much the covered companies emit in terms of greenhouse gases. And if you look at how those compare in the system, in every year the system has been in operation, there's been more supply than demand, which means that there's an imbalance, and you start to build up a surplus of those allowances that are being banked, as you mentioned, by companies, by other participants in the market. And this on its own isn't necessarily a bad thing, but if you look at the ability of the market to constrain emissions, that balance between supply and demand over time is going to be important to look at to understand if the market is going to be in a position to constrain emissions. The price in the market, in terms of how much those allowances cost, can still provide an effect on emissions no matter what, even if the overall market isn't binding. But there's a difference if the market has more demand for allowances than there is supply for allowances, versus the other way. And that also affects prices, which generally, in an oversupplied market, you would have lower prices, which again have less than of an effect. And one of the things I think that's really interesting here is that means then that if cap and trade is in a situation where it's not really set up currently to be a driver of emissions reductions, that means other kinds of policies have to carry that load. And ultimately, you want the whole policy, or the whole portfolio of policies, to be successful. It doesn't have to be one or the other necessarily, but you want a plan and a strategy that ends up getting you to the goals that you're trying to reach.
Okay, so on the subject of research papers, in another project, you and your team did a retrospective analysis of California's greenhouse gas emissions, and you found that the 2020 goals were achieved earlier. What would you say was a main cause of this?
Great, yes, that's also an excellent question. And so in this analysis, one of the things that the state had announced, this was in, I think, 2018, where they had just released their official numbers for the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the year 2016, so a couple of years earlier. And in that year, for the first time, the overall economy-wide emissions in California fell below the 2020 target, and they've gone down further since then. So, you know, all indications are that in this year, in 2020, once that data is available, that it will be well below that 2020 target. And so achieved, as you said, 4 years earlier. And so, yes, we wanted to look exactly at what were some of the reasons why this happened. And one of the things we were interested in, kind of building on what I was talking about just now before, is that this was in the late 2000s, 2006, 2007, 2008, that is when California was putting together its first portfolio of climate policies that were intended to achieve the 2020 target, where they, again, made forecasts and set some expectations about what emissions were going to do if we just stayed on a business as usual pathway, and what emissions might do if all of these policies were implemented. And you can compare those expectations to what has actually happened again in the real world and try to say, well, you know, how much then of us getting to that target early was those policies doing what they were expected to do, and how much was other factors that maybe weren't anticipated. One of the big additional things that happened in that time frame was the Great Recession back in 2009, 2010 in particular, which had a major effect on economic activity in California, just as we're seeing again now, and on emissions of greenhouse gases. And so one of the things we were looking at was, to what extent could you look at those kinds of changes in economic activity and economic development and its effects on emissions that were things that, you know, sort of aren't related directly to the climate policies in the same way versus the effects of the policies themselves. And so what we found was that originally that emission, that economic effect played a really big role in terms of getting to the target early. Policies have also played a significant and increasing role, where now I would say that the policies are the dominant force in terms of, on the whole, in terms of moving below that business as usual down to a lower target. But the recession was really, and the aftermath of that was something that also played a really important role. Another thing that happened is that if you look at where the emissions reductions are occurring, they're almost predominantly in the electricity sector. And so certainly other kinds of market forces, some of that is the policies where renewable portfolio standards and other kinds of policies directly affected electricity sector emissions, but also the economic changes in prices for both renewable energies and also natural gas made coal less competitive, for instance. And so you started to see, for both because of market reasons and because of policy reasons, a big shift away from any use of coal for electricity in California, and a significant ramp up in the use of renewable energies. And so those are then reasons why you see that big decline in the emissions associated with electricity use in California. On the other hand, transportation is one where for a while it was going down after the recession, but it had started to go back up. And you know, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves coming out of the current time when people are driving a lot less. But it's been harder to think about how you really get to those deeper reductions in transportation without more fundamental changes, like bringing in much more electric vehicles or zero emissions vehicles, thinking again about how we deal with other kinds of transportation, like air travel or heavy trucking. And California, again, and other places around the world are starting to think about those other kinds of harder to decarbonize parts of the emissions equation, where you really need to be looking at where emissions are coming from across different sectors. And again, I think this is something where that provides really a test bed for what are the kinds of policies you might pursue in other parts of the world, then what's working, what's not working, how do you do things most effectively?
Yeah, that's it's an interesting way, because it's always hard to really put a reason on these multifaceted situations.
Right.
Yeah. What advice would you have for some of, you know, the youth or, you know, high schoolers and middle schoolers who want to really pursue environmental science and climate change policy?
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, I think it's a really fascinating field to be in. And it's one that I think is going to be, again, defining issues of our time in the next coming decades. And so really a rich place to work and really an important place to work. One, you know, fundamental thing I think that's important that relates to all the things we've talked about today is that there's a real importance of understanding how systems work. That can be both how the Earth system works, how the climate system works, but also how human systems, political systems, economic systems work, and how all of those interact together as well. That is probably the most critical thing I think that's important if you're thinking about learning about these things, because that ultimately defines what happens in the real world, all of those kinds of interactions. In terms of getting involved and thinking about different roles and ways to get involved, certainly I think the scientific world and research world is really an interesting place to be. That's where I started, certainly. And I think that there's also really important roles to play in government, in the private sector, again, also in civil society and advocacy, and also in the interfaces between all of these different parts of society as well, where I think there's really important roles to play in translating what's coming out of the research community into how that informs policymaking, thinking about how private sector innovation and R&D and other kinds of aspects like that can really feed back into what's possible to do in terms of policy and reducing greenhouse gases. And so, you know, I would say that if you're thinking about getting involved in this, there's not just one way to do that, and different people may be more or less interested in different parts of the issue, but it's great to try out different roles, and it's great to get exposed to those different kinds of options through internships, through other ways of getting involved. And so those are some of the suggestions I would have.
Well, thank you for that advice. And thank you for joining us today on our first episode of STEMZ Perspectives. It was great to have you and talk about these issues with climate change policy, these really advice and all these new action plans for the future. So thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been really interesting to speak with you and you know, learn so much in just a short amount of time about what you're doing and what we can all do to help with green recoveries and climate change.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you both as well.
I hope you guys enjoyed our first episode and found it interesting. We learned a lot about climate change policy, how we can actually contribute to positively affect it, and the future about climate change, and how we really need to use this turning point to our advantage.
So you can find more out about Young Scientist Journal and indeed STEMZ Perspectives on our website and our social media handles, which will hopefully be linked in the description. You can also visit anchor.fm/STEMZ-perspectives to leave us a voice message or comment, which we may feature in our next episode. We'll be back on the 21st with the next episode of STEMZ Perspectives. So we'll see you then.